So Isaiah, and everybody else too, but especially Isaiah. I'm not sure why, just because. What's special to Isaiah? Okay, great. So we're studying out the book of Daniel. We're going to do probably 4 classes. We'll see. All right, and let's see, little review here. What is the theme, or what are the main messages of the book of Daniel? No, 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 you can't look. That's not, no. You're supposed to remember. All right, you can look. God, okay, close. God rules the nations, do not fear. All right, and how to remain righteous and loyal to God in a world which is doing its very best to get you to compromise that. Got it? Okay. So, God is in control. About that. Okay, good. So, remember, Daniel in the Old Testament, Revelation in the New Testament, the audience is a group of Jews who are persecuted in a period about 400 years after the time that the book of Daniel was written. Because Daniel is a book in a genre of which there is exactly one. It is a history book of the future. And then we talked about there's 2 sections of Daniel which might seem to not be clear how they're even combined. So there's Daniel 1, 3, 4, 5, and 6, which are very practical stories where Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are being put into very, very challenging situations. And the question is, will they be loyal and faithful to God or not? And by the way, we know the answer, but that's okay. All right. And the other part of the book, chapter 2 and 7 through 12, are these visions, these prophetic visions. Most prophets principally say, thus says the Lord. This is God's message to you. And only to a smaller extent do they say things about the future. Well, Daniel is not a prophet in the usual sense, because most of his prophecy is actually predictions of the future. And we're going to see crazy precise predictions, but that's not going to be until 2 weeks from now when we go over that. Okay, we talked about the date of writing. We talked about the historical background. Let me just review 4 empires. Babylon, Persian Mede, Greek, and Roman. All right, and that's going to be the historical background. Antiochus Epiphanes, the persecution comes during the Greek period, and we'll get back to that. If you don't know that right now, it's fine. All right, here's the Babylonian Empire, during which Daniel was, along with his 3 friends, were taken into captivity in Babylon. And then the Persian Empire, which actually began right before the book of Daniel ends, at least in our story, under Cyrus. All right, and then the Empire of Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great is a character in Daniel, even though he didn't live for about 200 and something years after Daniel died. And then Rome, I didn't bother to show you a map of Rome. So there's that outline. We did Daniel chapter 1. Daniel chapter 1 is an example of staying righteous under pressure in a kind of like in a work situation. At some time in your life, you're going to be in a situation where the people you're working for are going to expect you to do something which breaks ethical, moral, whatever, loyalty to God. And the question is, what are you going to do about that? So Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, and Daniel decide, they basically said, we are not going to eat this food which is unclean. And they challenged, they said, you know, the thing about not eating. The bottom line is, God came through for them, and they just refused, absolutely refused. In fact, they took this challenge of being asked to compromise and to compromise their loyalty to God as an opportunity rather than a problem. And then God blessed them and gave them all kinds of cool stuff, and they entered the service of the king. All right, then we skip Daniel chapter 2 because that is one of these prophecies of the future. Then we're in Daniel chapter 3. We were doing that when time ran out. Daniel chapter 3, somewhat similar but also different. Here the pressure is not so much a work kind of pressure to compromise your convictions. It's more like a religious pressure. The pressure was to sort of combined to syncretize their Judaism with Babylonian sorts of worship. So Nebuchadnezzar sets up this 70-foot high statue in the plains of Dura, and he says, when we blow the horn and flute and zither and lyre and all those things, everybody needs to bow down, and if you don't, we have the fiery furnace, right? And then we ask, well, what would you do? Would you do that? Because the bottom line is, if you don't, you're going to die. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego must have thought, well, God brought us here for a purpose, obviously. He raised us up to this amazing influential position under Nebuchadnezzar. Surely he doesn't want us to die now. So, and then we ask, well, what if they had bowed down to that statue? Would that have meant they would go to hell or something like that? And we decided, no, probably not, because if that's true, then every time you sin, you know what I'm saying. And yet they didn't do it. They didn't bow down. And the cool thing is, these teenagers, under incredible peer pressure, the most incredible, amazing peer pressure. And I'm telling you, peer pressure is real. Everybody here knows it. High school is even worse. Peer pressure is even worse in high school, but it's tough in college, that's for sure. Anyway, so they stand up for God. It's pretty awesome. And then Nebuchadnezzar, he's looking at it and says, who are those twerps, those teenagers? He was working for them. He knew who they were. He said, bring them up on stage. So now Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, and Daniel, probably 15, 18 years old, something like that, are standing before the most powerful man in the world. He says, who do you think you are? What God can save you from me? And you have to understand, according to all outward appearances, he's got a really good point. Because who conquered who? Whose God conquered whose God? His God conquered their God. And the stuff from their temple was sitting in his treasury. In fact, they were actually hostages. So he's like, you know, excuse me, what are you depending on, right? And I love the way they responded. King Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to deliver us from it, and he will deliver us from your majesty's hand. All right, but how will he deliver them from his majesty's hand? By saving them from the fire? Or by, in the end, they go to heaven? How? So they're expressing a confidence. Did they expect to not be burned to a crisp? And the answer is, we have no reason to think they expected that. They knew that God could do it. And this brings up a point. You know, when everything's going great, it's easy to believe that God's in control, right? But the thing is, when things are not going great, when you end up on probation at school and you're about to get kicked out of school, or, you know, not that that ever happened to anybody in this room, or when you're dealing with a chronic illness that is messing up your life to the point where you feel like you can't even move forward with your life. Not that that ever happened to anybody in this room here tonight, etc. Stuff happens. God allows things to happen that it just doesn't seem fair or right. And so the question is, are you going to trust God? Are you going to trust God in those difficult moments? And I shared a couple of examples. I remember one time, you know, again, the world says you guys are too committed. This whole thing about being a disciple and giving up everything you have, go anywhere, do anything, you guys are too committed. You need to back off. I remember one time I was sharing with a guy who's in my lab, and he was very religious, and not only religious, he was, you know, every once in a while you meet one of those religious people that they're just flat out sincere. You know what I'm saying? That's just one of those guys. You know what I'm saying? Anyway, so we're just talking, and I shared, you know, that I'd been baptized recently, and, you know, I became a Christian when I was get baptized, blah, blah, blah. And he said, no, wait a minute. Are you telling me that if you're not baptized, you're going to hell? All right. So you know what I did, right? I said, well, that's, I'm not here to judge anybody. I'm just telling you what I understand the scripture. You know, I did that whole backpedaling thing. And honestly, I'm not I didn't bring it up to judge anybody. I was just sharing my conviction. Anyway, so he said, no. I want to tell me right now. I'm not going to let you out on this one. He says, do you think that I'm going to hell? I said, well, yeah, actually I do. That was a tough moment. And by the way, I hope I was wrong. I really do. And so, are you going to stand up for your religious convictions in tough situations? So anyway, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they held up pretty well. So anyway, then it said, we already read the section. So then it says, and then Nebuchadnezzar's mind changed. He became even more angry. He was out of control. And I'm telling you, if you stand up for God, if you're like, no, I will not back down, somebody's going to get ticked off at you sometime because they're used to intimidating religious people and they get kind of wimpy. You know what I'm saying? And he says, make the fire 7 times hotter. And then he says, basically, guys, I'll give you one more chance. All right? We're going to make those instruments blow one more time and you bow down to that statue. Otherwise, you're toast. So anyway, they're being dragged off. And I'm telling you, it was not too late. It was not too late. Imagine what these young, probably about age in here or a little bit younger than the people in here, imagine as they're being dragged off to the flames. What were they thinking? What was going through their mind? Man, how did God let this happen? And it wasn't too late. I'm telling you right now, they could have just said, hold on, never mind. Here, would you blow the horns, flute, zither, and lyre one more time, please? You know, it wasn't too late. It was so hot that the soldiers who were there to throw them in got burned themselves, right? You know the story. And then Nebuchadnezzar's looking and he sees Shadrach. Did I mention Daniel was not in this story? If I said Daniel, he was not there. Anyway, he says he sees 4 people in the flames. And I'll tell you right now, at this point, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they were fired up. All right. Now, the story has a happy ending, but I'm going to claim the meaning, the application, and the purpose of the story is affected virtually not at all by the fact that they did not die. It doesn't change the story very much at all. Because, you know, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were faithful to God. Amen? So that's that story. There they are. There's supposedly Nebuchadnezzar. There's the 3. And who's that other one in the flames? Some people have speculated it was Jesus. It was Archangel Michael. I don't know who it was. Angelic being. Kind of cool. All right. Let's finish up. Let's read the last couple of verses in Daniel 3. And then we'll get into Daniel 4. All right. All right. Then Nebuchadnezzar said, verse 28, praise be to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and rescued his servants. They trusted in him and defied the king's command and were willing to give up their lives rather than serve or worship any god except their own God. Therefore, I decree that the people of any nation or language who say anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be cut into pieces and their houses be turned into piles of rubble, for no other God can save in this way. Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. Okay, great. So now we're in Daniel chapter 4. I hope we get through Daniel chapter 5 today, so we'll do 2 stories. Daniel chapter 4, I call it A King Eats Grass. Now, this is many, many years later. We don't know how many years later, but 10, 20, perhaps even 30. Nebuchadnezzar ruled from 605 BC to around 575 or 570. He ruled for quite a while. Anyway, King Nebuchadnezzar. Now, this is a letter not from Daniel, but from Nebuchadnezzar to his people. To the nations and peoples of every language who live on all the earth, may you prosper greatly. It is my pleasure to tell you about the miraculous signs and wonders that the Most High God has performed for me. How great are his signs, how mighty his wonders. Verse 4, I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at home in my palace, contented and prosperous. I had a dream that made me afraid. As I was lying in bed, the images and visions that passed through my mind terrified me. So I commanded all the wise men of Babylon to be brought before me to interpret the dream for me. When the magicians, enchanters, astrologers, and diviners came, I told them the dream. The dream was essentially what you see there, a huge tree with many, many birds, roosting in the tree, and all the animals of the field gathering around that tree. And by the way, this is a vision that represents Nebuchadnezzar himself and Babylon. All right, verse 13. In the visions I saw while lying in bed, I looked, and there before me was a holy one, a messenger coming down from heaven. He called in a loud voice, cut down the tree, this tree. Trim off its branches. Strip off its leaves. Scatter its fruit. Let the animals flee from under it and the birds from its branches. But let the stump and its roots be bound with iron and bronze. Remain in the ground and the grass of the field. Let him be drenched with dew of heaven. Let him live with the animals among the plants of the earth. Let his mind be changed to from that of a man. And let him be given the mind of an animal till seven times pass for him. The decision is announced by messengers. The holy ones declare the verdict so that the living may know. So in this case, the dream is not a dream that Daniel had. It's a dream that Nebuchadnezzar had, as was the case in Daniel chapter 2 as well. Later on in Daniel 7, 8 through 12, it'll be dreams that Daniel has. All right, so anyway, all the other astrologers and all those other fake religious people, and there's a lot of fake religious people in his kingdom, just like there's a whole lot of fake religious people running around today, and most of them probably call themselves Christians, doing all these fake miracles and stuff like that. Anyway, so he calls for Belteshazzar. And who's Belteshazzar? That's Daniel, right? He calls Daniel, and he asks him to interpret the dream. He says, but you can, verse 18, because the spirit of the holy gods is on you. Then Daniel, also called Belteshazzar, was greatly perplexed for a time, and his thoughts terrified him. So the king said, Belteshazzar, do not let the dream or its meaning alarm you. The reason he's upset is he's about to give Nebuchadnezzar some super, super bad news. And generally, giving the most powerful man in the world bad news is not a really good idea, right? So Nebuchadnezzar says, hey, dude, even if it's bad news about me, I promise I'm not going to kill you. All right, good luck on that one. Hopefully not, right? All right, anyway, Belteshazzar answered, my lord, if only the dream applied to your enemies and its meaning to your adversaries, the tree you saw, which grew large and strong with its top touching the sky, visible to the whole earth, with beautiful leaves, abundant fruit, food for all the living, etc., etc., etc. You, verse 22, majesty, are that tree. You become great and strong. Your greatness has grown until it reaches the sky, and your dominion extends to the distant parts of the earth. And Nebuchadnezzar is saying, yes, that's me. That's definitely me. Your majesty saw a holy one, a messenger coming down from heaven and saying, cut down the tree, destroy it, but leave the stump bound with iron and bronze in the grass of the field, etc. Verse 24. This is the interpretation, your majesty, and this is the decree the Most High has issued against my lord the king. You'll be driven away from the people. You will live with the wild animals. You'll eat grass like the ox and be drenched with the dew of heavens seven times, probably 7 years, not 7 months, given what happened, will pass by for you until you acknowledge that the Most High is sovereign over all the kings on earth and gives them to anyone who wishes. By the way, there are other reports, not of actually Nebuchadnezzar, but of Nabonidus, his son. Actually, there's a similar story in the Babylonian Chronicles, kind of like this, although it's of a different king. Now, all right, I believe the biblical version, but it's kind of interesting. There's another story of King George, not a story, it's King George of England, King George III, who basically went crazy. And so for several years, he was not really ruling England at all because he was crazy. But every once in a while, they kind of trot him out and sort of do an appearance and then kind of hide him back. So this idea of a king kind of losing it for a period of time is not unprecedented in history. Just a little side note. Anyway, All right, 7 times will pass for you until you acknowledge the Most High is sovereign over all the kingdoms of the earth and gives them to anyone he wishes. Now, what would have been better than to let 7 times pass by before you acknowledge that? Probably, how about like one day instead, right? Nebuchadnezzar was a little bit prideful. All right, your kingdom will be restored to you when you acknowledge that the heaven rules. Therefore, your majesty, be pleased to accept my advice. Renounce your sins by doing what is right and your wickedness by being kind to the oppressed. It may be that even your prosperity will continue. All this happened to King Nebuchadnezzar. So what he did was, briefly, he kind of partially repented. You know, people have some really crazy bad stuff happen to them. Suddenly they get religious, right? And then it's a few months later, and you know, they say, God, you know, if you help me out of this situation, I'll just, you know, I'll never get drunk again, or that kind of stuff. It's one of those deals, right? But it kind of wore off after a while. So 12 months later, as the king was walking on the roof of the royal palace of Babylon, he said, is not this the great Babylon that I have built as the royal residence by my mighty power and for the glory of my majesty? Even as the words were on his lips, a voice came from heaven. This is what is decreed for you, King Nebuchadnezzar. Your royal authority has been taken from you. You will be driven away from the people. You will live with the wild animals. You'll eat grass like the ox. 7 times will pass by for you until you acknowledge the Most High is sovereign over all the kingdoms of the earth, and he gives them to anyone he wishes. And he gave it to you in the first place, Nebuchadnezzar. Immediately what had been said about Nebuchadnezzar was fulfilled. He was driven away from the people. He ate grass like the ox. His body was drenched with the dew of the heavens until his hair grew like the feathers of an eagle and his nails like the claws of a bird. At the end of that time, I, Nebuchadnezzar, raised my eyes towards heaven. 7 years later, and my sanity was restored. I praised the Most High. I honored and glorified him who lives forever. His dominion is an eternal dominion. His kingdom endures from generation to generation. All the peoples of the earth are regarded as nothing. He does as he pleases with the powers of heaven and with the peoples of the earth. No one can hold him back his hand or say to him, what have you done? So Nebuchadnezzar, he's kind of repented at this point, right? At the same time that my sanity was restored, my honor and splendor were returned to me for the glory of my kingdom. My advisors and nobles sought me out, and I was restored to my throne because it became even greater than before. Now I can Nebuchadnezzar praise and exalt and glorify the King of heaven because everything he does is right and all his ways are just. And here's the conclusion of the matter. And those who walk in pride, he is able to humble. In fact, we could have just read that verse. That would have been good enough because that's what the whole chapter is about. So when we walk in pride, I would say not only is God able to humble us, I'd say God flat out will humble us. All right? Pride in our accomplishments. I'm so awesome. I got this great degree and this great job and this beautiful, I don't know, hairdo and awesome muscles or whatever that thing is. You know what I'm saying? And that happens to religious people. This great church, you know, we came here and the church is doing so much better and this person got baptized and, you know, and this Bible talk and, you know, all this great hope thing. You know, we can boast in our accomplishments so easily. 1 Corinthians 4, verse 7. I like this one. 1 Corinthians 4, verse 7. Where Paul asks the Corinthians a rhetorical question. For who makes you different from anyone else? What do you have that you did not receive? And if you received it, why do you boast as though you did not? So God's asking us a question tonight. Of all the things that you have that make you so awesome, how many of them did you create? In fact, is there anything that you have you did not receive from God? Well, sure, yeah, your arrogance and your drunkenness and some of that stuff. And the thing is, there's 2 ways God can humble us. I really believe this. There's 2 ways God can humble us. One way he can humble us is by blessing us like crazy. The other way he can humble us is by taking it all away. Got that? There's two ways God can humble you. And the story of Nebuchadnezzar is a perfect example. Two ways God can keep you humble. One is by blessing you tremendously. Right? But that one's tricky, right? You know, there's different Christian gifts. You know, the gift of giving and the gift of leadership, the gift of whatever. You know, one of the most difficult Christian gifts to have is the gift of wealth. That's a tough one. Very, very few people could handle that one. So anyway, Nebuchadnezzar learned the lesson. Deuteronomy 8, 6 through 18. That's where God says, He says, when I bless you, don't forget where the blessing came from. God says, I gave you the ability to produce wealth. Okay, and so this is a lifelong essential message for us. Is we always need to remember every single good thing we have is a gift from God. And if we forget that, God is going to take it away from us. All right? You know, Nebuchadnezzar said, man, look at this city that I built. And it was the greatest city of the ancient world. His empire was not the greatest empire. The Persian Empire was greater. The Greek Empire was greater. But Babylon was the greatest city of the ancient world. He says, I built this city. Right? Well, actually, I don't know how many bricks he laid. How many bricks do you think he laid? You know, the famous Hanging Gardens of Babylon, one of the seven ancient wonders of the world. If you go to the Pergamon Museum in Berlin, the actual wall that made up the city. I mean, Babylon was an amazing city. The city stands on a broad plain. This is Herodotus, the Greek historian who actually visited Babylon. It is an exact square, 13.5 miles in length on each side. Imagine that. That's a big city. So that its entire circuit is however long it is. It's surrounded in the first place by a deep moat full of water, behind which rises a wall 50 cubits in width, 87 feet thick wall, 200 in height. On the top, along the edge of the wall, they construct a building on a single chamber facing one another, leaving between them room for four horse chariot to turn. Pretty amazing city. So what is the theme of this chapter? Last verse in the chapter. What is the theme of this chapter? Those who walk in pride, he will humble. All right, let's get to Daniel chapter 5. All right, Daniel chapter 5, I call this party animal meets man of God. Party animal meets man of God. The writing on the wall. I love this story. It's a great story. It's a little bit shorter story. That is a story. It's a long story. It takes a long time to read it. Oh, my goodness. All right, great. So, this is, again, another 30 years or so later. Daniel has now been in captivity for about 68 years. The year is 538 B.C. He went into captivity 605 B.C., Nebuchadnezzar is long dead. He was succeeded by this other guy called Evil Merodach. That's an interesting name, Evil Merodach. And then he died, and then Nabonidus took the throne, and now it's Belteshazzar, which is a very similar name to Belshazzar, which is Daniel's name. All right, and so I'll tell you the story later on when that becomes relevant. King Belshazzar gave a great banquet for 1,000 of his nobles and drank wine with them. When Belshazzar was drinking his wine, he gave orders to bring in the gold and silver goblets that Nebuchadnezzar, his father, actually his grandfather, just so you know, had taken from the temple in Jerusalem. So the king and his nobles, his wives and his concubines might drink from them. Bad idea. Drinking, getting drunk, and doing a toast to the gods, to pagan gods, in the vessels that had been used in the temple of God in Jerusalem. Bad idea. Really bad idea. I'll tell you right now, Nebuchadnezzar would have never done this. Never. But that's kind of what happens. You get a dynasty, and after a couple generations, they start to feel like they're something special, and when they're really not very special at all. This guy, Belshazzar, he doesn't come across very well at all. Not at all. He is a partying animal. Anyway, so they brought in the gold goblets that had been taken from the temple of God in Jerusalem, and the king and his nobles, his wives and his concubines drank from them. As they drank the wine, they praised the gods of gold and silver, bronze and iron, wood and stone. Suddenly, the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster on the wall. By the way, the room where this happened has been excavated. And there is an actual wall. The original plaster's not there, but you can actually see the wall where this happened. All right? Wrote on the plaster on the wall near the lampstand in the royal palace. The king watched the hand as it wrote. Can you imagine? Oh, boy, I'm in big trouble. It's like you were robbing us, doing something really bad, and the cops walk in. You're like, oh, not good. Not good. His face turned pale. He was frightened, so frightened his legs became weak. His knees were knocking, and something tells me he might have even soiled his pants. What do you think? I think so. The king summoned the enchanters, astrologers, and diviners. They always do that. They always go back to their sort of fake religious-y, you know, praise the Lord, hallelujah, you know, all that stuff. Go to that. All right. Then he said to the wise men of Babylon, whoever reads this writing and tells me what it means will be clothed in purple and have the gold chain placed around their neck. He will be made the third highest ruler in the kingdom. Let's stop there. All right. By the way, that very night, Cyrus conquered Babylon. That very night, Belshazzar was killed. So, probably having the third place in the kingdom was not a really great position to have that night. Now, here's the thing. Why the third highest place in the kingdom? There's an interesting note, because people say that Daniel is not accurate history. In fact, Herodotus doesn't even mention Belshazzar. Neither does Thucydides. None of the ancient historians mention Belshazzar. All of them agree... All of them agreed that Nabonidus was the last king of Babylon. So therefore, you know how the critics of the Bible go, yeah, the Bible's made up stories, blah, 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 blah. Well, then in this ziggurat in Ur, which is actually in, you know, not that far, it's south of Babylon, they found an inscription and explained what happened. What happened was Nabonidus had a palace coup. Evil Merodach was the son of Nebuchadnezzar. Nabonidus had him killed. All right, and he took the throne, but the problem was he was not a legitimate ruler. So what he did was he married the daughter of Nebuchadnezzar. And he had a son, his name was Belshazzar, all mentioned in this inscription. So Belshazzar, therefore, was the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar and was the legitimate heir. So what Nabonidus did was he had Belshazzar rule as the regent king. In fact, Nabonidus went off into sin, literally. Sin was the moon god, and there was this city out in the Arabian desert. And basically, Nabonidus was pretty much an absent king. So by the time this happened, Belshazzar had ruled as effective ruler for about 12 years. So remember, those who say the Bible is a bunch of fantasy and stories made up, partly because we know that, because obviously Belshazzar is not even a real person, tables turned. How did Daniel know that Belshazzar was the actual last king of Babylon? And by the way, why did he offer the third place in the kingdom? Because who occupied the second place in the kingdom? No, Belshazzar did. Belshazzar did. He was the regent king. So not only does that prove the accuracy of the Bible, all right, not only that, but in other words, details that don't even really make sense. In other words, if you were making up this story, you wouldn't make this up. you know, if you're saying that Belshazzar was the last king, then he would give the second place. But no, he gives the third place. So this confirms in dramatic fashion the historical accuracy of the book of Daniel. And people who say different, well, they mainly just don't even know what they're talking about. I'll just say that. But let's continue. All right. So anyway, all these fake religious people come in and they say, no, we can't interpret the writing on the wall. And so Belshazzar is getting very, very nervous. The queen, hearing the voices, by the way, the queen is... the queen... The queen, who is the wife of... The queen is the mother of Nabonidus' wife. In other words, she is the wife of evil Merodach. So she was married to the king. Anyway, so this queen comes in, hearing the voices of the king and his nobles. So she's not the queen of Belshazzar. She's the queen of Nabonidus, just so you know. Anyway. May the king live forever, she says. Don't be alarmed. Don't look so pale. There's a man in your kingdom who has the spirit of the holy gods in him. In the time of your father, who is found to have insight and intelligence and wisdom like that of the gods. Your father, King Nebuchadnezzar, appointed him chief of the magicians, enchanters, and astrologers. You know what we're talking about, right? Right? Your grandfather... Belshazzar, Nebuchadnezzar appointed him chief of all the magicians. Who are we talking about? No. Well, yeah, okay. Daniel. Belshazzar, that's his other name. Good point. You got it on that one. Anyway. You see, in that time of your father was found to have insight and intelligence and wisdom like that of the gods. Your father, King Nebuchadnezzar, appointed him chief of the magicians, enchanters, and astrologers, and diviners. He did this because Daniel, whom the king called Belteshazzar, very good, thank you, was found to have a keen mind and knowledge, understanding, blah, blah, blah. So Daniel was brought before the king, and the king said to him, "Are you Daniel, one of the exiles my father the king brought from Judah? I've heard that the spirits of the gods are on you." Verse 15, "The wise men and enchanters were brought before me to read this writing and tell me what it says, but they couldn't explain it. Now I've heard that you were able to give interpretations." Daniel, you're awesome and amazing. You're so, Daniel. Then Daniel answered the king, verse 17, "You may keep your gifts for yourself. You may give rewards to someone else. Nevertheless, I will read the writing for the king and tell him what it means. Your majesty, the most high God, gave your father Nebuchadnezzar sovereignty and greatness and glory and splendor. But you're just a pipsqueak partying animal. Because of the high position he gave him, all the nations and peoples of every language dreaded and feared him. Those the king wanted to put to death, he put to death. And those he wanted to spare, he spared. Those he wanted to promote, he promoted. And those he wanted to humble, he humbled. But when his heart became arrogant and hardened with pride, he was deposed from his royal throne and stripped of his glory. He was driven away from the people and given the mind of an animal. He lived with the wild donkeys and ate grass like an ox." We know that story, right? Verse 22. "But you, Belshazzar, his son," actually his grandson, "have not humbled yourself, though you knew all this. Instead, you set up for yourself against the Lord of heaven. You had the goblets from his temple brought to you, and you and your nobles, your wives, and your concubines drank wine from them. You praised the gods of silver and gold, bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which cannot see or hear or understand, but you did not honor the God who holds in his hand your life and all of your ways. Therefore, he sent this hand, and now he's going to interpret it. Mene, mene, tekel, parsed." Mene means counted. Mene also means finished or completed. Tekel means weighed. And parsed means divided. Basically says, you've been counted. And the count is now complete. You've been weighed on the balance, and you're going to be cut up and divided. That very night, his kingdom was destroyed. God has numbered the days of your reign and brought it to an end. You've been weighed on the scales and found wanting. Your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. Then at Belshazzar's command, Daniel was clothed in purple. A gold chain was placed around his neck, which he didn't really want to have, I'll tell you right now. He was proclaimed the third highest ruler in the kingdom. That very night, Belshazzar, king of the Babylonians, was slain. And Darius the Mede took over the kingdom at the age of 62. Who rules the nations? God rules the nations. And he can take people in and he can take people out. Yes? Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. Daniel 6. We don't have time to do Daniel 6. That's all right. We have 2 weeks to go. And so we'll do one more story and then we'll do the prophecies. But you know the story about Daniel 6. Daniel was the most incredible worker. Daniel 6 is really about what it means to be a single person on the job. All right. And so, and we're going to see, I don't know why they had that picture, a nude picture. I shouldn't put that up there. You don't really need to see that, but, you know, if they have it in an ancient thing, you can show it, right? It's, you know, it's right. Nude pictures and art, it's okay because it's art. All right. Anyway, questions, comments? I'll hand it back to whoever. Okay, great. So we have 2 more classes. We'll do Daniel 6, and then we'll start to look at these crazy, ridiculous, insane prophecies in Daniel. Thank you very much.